Mentorship programs have a race problem. Most of those seeking a mentor are teens of color. The vast majority of mentors are white. So how do mentor programs address this? I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. WHYY's Kevin McCrory takes us to a one-of-a-kind coffee shop in Philadelphia's Brewery Town neighborhood to find out.
Have a good day.
When you see Najee Taylor behind the counter of the Monkey and the Elephant Cafe, he shows no signs of his past scars, but they're there.
I really honestly didn't know why I was in foster care when I went in, because I was 11. Only thing I was worried about was getting home.
Taylor has never known his father. He was separated from his two siblings and sent into foster care when his mother could no longer handle the pressures of single parenthood.
She kind of like exploded mentally, and it kind of took a turn for the worse. So like, one thing that I was scared of was her not knowing me anymore. It's kind of emotional.
Despite his rocky upbringing, Taylor managed to graduate high school, and now 20, he's been working a mix of jobs and living in a transitional shelter in Kensington. One of his jobs has been as a barista at the Monkey and the Elephant in Brewery Town, which doubles as a mentorship program with the slogan, supporting former foster youth through great coffee.
Being reincarcerated, being incarcerated in general, experiencing homelessness. There's lots of really bad statistics that go along with youth leaving the foster care system.
Founder Lisa Michaelis runs the operation with two managers who have years of coffee experience. The rest of the employees are former foster youth. Most have been young African-American men like Taylor. Through an 8-month program, mentees get help with things like opening a bank account, finding stable housing, learning how to budget, and connecting with counseling services if interested.
So we're really looking at the whole individual, figuring out what their needs are, and figuring out how we can address them using the coffee shop as the vehicle to do all of that.
But Michaelis, who's a white 31-year-old from the suburbs, is upfront with the fact that she comes from a very different world than Taylor and others she mentors.
So I think every day I attempt to figure out how, as a young white female, I can connect with a bunch of young black men. And I often think it's a little bit ironic that I rely so heavily on my family right now when I'm basically providing a support system for others who don't have that as an option.
For Taylor, Michaelis's efforts have been worthwhile, and he credits the coffee shop for boosting his confidence and self-esteem.
Mentally, it just lets me know that I belong. Mentally, it just lets me know that when it's all said and done, I can come to work and know that somebody cares about, you know, how my day was, or, you know, what I go through, and, you know, what my accomplishments are.
But he says the racial divide is real, especially when it comes to taking on the big, often culturally sensitive issues in the news.
I really can't talk about world issues with Lisa or, like, any of the staff members, like, to be honest, because, like, I don't want to put them in a, like, I might say I don't want to put them in a position because I would love to talk about it with them, to hear what they had to say.
This dynamic isn't a surprise to Abigail Ellis, the executive director of the Mentoring Partnership and Resource Center, which seeks to help kids find mentors all over eastern Pennsylvania.
People who are mentoring are informal mentoring programs, tend to be white, and they tend to be more wealthy.
Since the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, Ellis's group has been holding training seminars that push mentors like Michaelis to better address race and privilege in their work.
We need to change the narrative around young black men and help them to create positive self-identities. And mentors are in a great position to do that, but we want to make sure that they have the skills and the techniques that they need and the confidence to do that as well.
Spurred in part by that training, recently on Taylor's last day of the program at the coffee shop, Michaelis gave him a sort of exit interview where she reflected on her own mentorship.
There's so many things that have happened in the past year that we've, you know, loosely talked about, but maybe not in depth as much as we could, to the point of me saying, like, Najee, how do you feel about this? Like, do you feel that your life is at risk? Do you feel that you could do something to change this? Like, we've talked about it, but maybe not to the extent that we could have for me to understand exactly what his feelings and thoughts were that went along with all of, you know, those horrible things that have happened.
This kind of openness is especially important as the number of African-American teachers, often natural mentors, has dwindled. In the Philadelphia School District, 86% of students are racial minorities, but only 30% of teachers are, a gap that's significantly widened. Although not as a teacher, Najee Taylor hopes to become part of the solution. He's already become a mentor himself to foster kids in their young teens, and he hopes to become a full-time child advocate for the Department of Human Services, where he feels he can make a difference for kids of all races.
I want people to light up when they see my face and know that, you know, Mr. Taylor is going to be there for them and everything like that, so that's what type of guy I am.
For WHYY News, I'm Kevin McCory.
Philadelphia's 99th mayor, Jim Kennedy, will be inaugurated into office Monday, January 4th, and in advance of that transition, NewsWorks Tonight is looking at the legacy of outgoing mayor Michael Nutter. In this evening's third installment of a seven-part series, let's look at his efforts to prioritize sustainability with Mark Allen Hughes, professor of practice at Penn Design, and Katie Bartolotta, Philly Outreach Coordinator for Penn Future. Katie, Mark, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks for having us, Dave.
And it's fortunate to have both of you here because you've both worked intimately with the mayor in this regard, but let's establish a couple of timelines. First of all, what did he inherit when he came into office in 2008?
Well, I think he inherited a number of strengths and a couple of challenges. The strengths included a city that had learned slowly to take on some big projects like NTI, like the beginnings of what would become the Philadelphia Naval Base Renaissance and so on. And an economy that showed no particular signs of collapsing anytime soon. The challenges that he inherited included things like a lost place, a city largely without a future in the economy that was emerging. And I think a big part of his campaign, his early candidacy, was trying to find a place for Philadelphia in that future. And that's really largely where the environmental agenda emerged from.
Though, Katie, the recession did hit, and though Philadelphia didn't suffer to the extent of other cities, notably Las Vegas, for example, it couldn't have helped propel his goals.
No, and I think we're seeing this with cities everywhere. We're kind of in the era of just a permanent fiscal crisis. So when you're talking about issues of sustainability, for example, and you're talking about the investments needed to make real change in the city, a lot of times the first question is, how are we funding this? And I think that's where a lot of these kind of initiatives were born, is thinking of some of this low-hanging fruit that could get us started on the path of making Philadelphia a more sustainable city.
Mark, you created the GreenWorks plan. What was the initial plan, and what was some of that low-hanging fruit?
The idea, as Katie was elaborating a minute ago, when the recession became clear and the depths of the recession became clear, it allowed us to frame the environmental agenda in its economic development terms. Especially for Philadelphians, especially for Philadelphia at that time, it was really not about polar bears or ice caps. It was really about unemployment, poverty, prosperity, the possibilities for prosperity. So much of the plan is oriented around saving money, around avoiding costs, and around seizing economic opportunities that we hoped were going to emerge and blossom around the clean energy economy, around retrofits and other kinds of things. It's really about, there may be some first costs, but these things all pay for themselves.
And I'll kind of piggyback on what Mark was saying here and talking about kind of that emphasis on the economy through the lens of sustainability. And I want to highlight one program that I think everybody can mutually agree from the city of Philadelphia has been something that's really put us on the national map, and that's Green City Clean Waters. You know, the city's green stormwater management plan that was worked out with the EPA and just represents one of those kind of great crossover sections where you've got what, you know, the Philadelphia Water Department champions is its triple bottom line benefits of social, economic, and environmental benefits all contained in one program. And I think we innovated our way out of a problem. And I think that right there is a perfect example of the legacy that this program and this administration is leaving behind.
Let's talk about how the efforts to date impact Philadelphia residents over the tenure of Mayor Nutter's administration.
The targets that have been exceeded or met or have come close are really targets about quality of life in the city, right? Many of these things are about increasing the amount of green space, increasing the tree canopy in the city, increasing the recycling rate. So many of the things where the city has made the most progress have actually been on quality of life things that affect how people live every day.
Mayor Nutter's inaugural included the pledge to make Philadelphia the number one green city in America. He set the bar high. What grade would each of you give him?
Oh, I'd absolutely give him an A. That goal gave those of us who were working on this agenda everything we could have asked. When you could walk into a commissioner's office and say, here is the mayor's stated goal. What are you going to do? How are you going to contribute to this? It was, you know, it was the perfect kind of organizational and political setting for taking on this ambitious planning process.
And Katie, if you were in that business,
you know, I'm gonna buck the system a little bit here. I'll give an A minus. I mean, it was a really great effort, but I think again, you know, giving an A means we're done being the greenest city in America. We've got to leave a little room for improvement, right?
Katie Bartolotta, Mark Allen Hughes, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thanks for having us, Dave.
Thank you.
Katie Bartolotta is Philly Outreach Coordinator for Penn Future. Mark Allen Hughes serves as professor of practice at Penn Design. He was the chief policy advisor to Mayor Michael Nutter and the founding director of sustainability for the city of Philadelphia, where he led the creation of the Greenworks Plan. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. King of Prussia is the biggest employment hub in the Philadelphia region outside of the city itself, and that's helping to bolster the case for a $1 billion transit project, connecting the area's malls and office parks to the Norristown high-speed line. WHYY's Laura Benchoff has this story from Montgomery County.
Right now, it takes about an hour and 20 minutes to get from Center City, Philadelphia, to the King of Prussia Mall by bus. A lot of that time, says Liz Smith, manager of SEPTA's long-range planning, is thanks to snarled traffic.
You never quite know exactly what you're going to get on the Schuylkill Expressway, and unfortunately, there's not really another great way.
The proposed extension of the Norristown High Speed Line would cut that time to less than an hour. And it's not only public transit that would benefit. According to a new study by the Economy League of Greater Philadelphia, motorists would get back upwards of 1.7 million hours they normally spend sitting in gridlock each year. That's in addition to a slew of other perks, including increased development, says the league's Nick Frontino.
Transit investment has been shown around the country and around the world to stimulate a variety of different economic benefits, from construction spending, environmental and safety benefits that come as a result of taking cars off the road.
But big infrastructure projects like this one take a lot of time, along with big bucks. The feds have paid $20 million for planning, but until more money can be drummed up from local and federal sources, Smith says,
it's tough to say for certain that it's going to happen.
Still, she's optimistic. If everything goes as planned, the extension would open in 2023. The last time SEPTA opened a new service was the airport line in the 80s. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benchoff.
Taking a look at this evening's headlines, Philadelphia City Council is calling on District Attorney Seth Williams to fire three prosecutors who exchanged sexually explicit and raunchy emails while working for the State Attorney General's office. The Philadelphia Inquirer reports today's resolution passed by a voice vote, meaning each member's vote was not officially tallied. The Democratic-controlled New Jersey Assembly is postponing a vote on pushing through legislation dealing with guns and mental illness. That bill was vetoed by Governor Chris Christie. The Assembly vote was suspended today after falling short of the support needed to rebuke the Republican governor who's running for the GOP presidential nomination. So far, none of the hundreds of vetoes by Governor Christie have been overturned by both the Senate and Assembly. 46 degrees, mostly clear skies at 620. You're listening to Newsworks tonight on WHYY. Hey, it's your chance to help us create top-notch radio programming that's suited to the needs of our audience and region. Participate by taking our survey at whyy.org/survey. Tonight's forecast, clear skies, low 37 degrees. Sunny tomorrow, Friday's high 50. Sunny days right through the weekend, high Saturday and Sunday around 52. Still ahead, at the age of 95, a jazz drummer prepares for one final gig after decades on the Philly scene.
I just love being around Philadelphia, and you could go to Atlantic City. This was when things were bright and good.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Newman University supports WHYY and encourages listeners who are looking to change life direction to discover the master's degree in pastoral clinical mental health counseling. The program can help prepare adults for professional licensure and roles in community counseling. Designed to integrate psychology and spirituality, this ecumenical program is open to people of all faith traditions. Details at newman.edu/WHYY. Newman University proudly supports WHYY.
Galbraith & Paul supports WHYY. The Hand Block Printing Studio in Manayunk holds their annual sample event on Saturday, December 5th from 10 to 5 at 116 Schurz Lane, offering pillows, fabric, wallpaper, lighting, and other artisan crafts. More at galbraithandpaul.com.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. There's nothing like a good story to inspire good art. Even better if there are superheroes. In the exhibit, The Wrath of the Gods, the Philadelphia Museum of Art is showcasing large works by masters that are as narrative as they are powerful. WHYY's Elizabeth Perez-Luna reports that the museum also brought in comic book artists to deliver a modern take on those superheroes.
If you remember your Greek mythology, Mount Olympus was not exactly a nice place. It was chaotic and contentious. The 12 Greek gods that ruled it fought fiercely for power and territory, and they did not like to be disobeyed. So when the Titan Prometheus stole the fire and gave it to humans, by Zeus he was going to be severely punished, eternally.
He's chained to a mountain. An eagle comes and devours his liver.
Says Christopher Atkins as he describes a Rubens painting, the centerpiece of the exhibition. Atkins works in the European Painting Department at the Philadelphia Museum of Art and curated this exhibit.
He's immortal, so he regenerates, and so this punishment happens day after day after day. And in our painting, we see the brutality of this. The eagle's talons are ripping into the flesh, blood is dripping down, the beak snares the liver from his abdomen, one of the talons gouges out his eyes.
Yet Atkins adds, a lit torch painted in the corner of the enormous canvas reminds us why he's undergoing this punishment.
And even more so, he locks eyes with the eagle. He grits his teeth. He bears this punishment for the betterment of mankind. And for me, that's a tremendously powerful image.
If that sounds like the stuff of graphic novels, that's exactly what inspired the museum and the local comic book publisher Locust Moon Press. 10 artists and writers were commissioned to interpret the myth. The result is a 25-page full-color book entitled Prometheus Eternal, represented in a variety of styles. Illustrator Yuko Shimizu reduced the drama to a one-page stylized drawing with all the symbols that matter.
Chains around the fire. Fire is the symbol, the most important part of who he is. And so without drawing him, drew the big ball of fire and the eagles attacking the fireball. So that's what I drew.
Throughout the centuries, the story of Prometheus has inspired inventors, artists, and composers. Because Atkins says,
and it depends on which classical source you read and which artistic vision you have, either he gave humanity literally fire, from which we cook food and technology and all sorts of things, or he gave us the creative spark.
A spark that has become a sort of eternal flame. Have no fear, Prometheus is here, says the Titan in writer Grant Morrison's strip, illustrated by Pharrell Dayrymple.
He pictures Prometheus as a superhero, complete with cape and flaming gold hair. He provides inspiration to scientists working on trying to cure for cancer, to artists, that this is his power. His superpower is inspiring.
So there you have it. In his anger, Zeus may have given Prometheus another kind of immortality. The Wrath of the Gods, masterpieces by Rubens, Michelangelo, and Titian, continues at the Philadelphia Museum of Art through the weekend. Elizabeth Perez Luna, WHYY News.
Tonight may be your last chance to hear one of Philadelphia's great jazz drummers. Charlie Rice started playing gigs in 1940 in West Philadelphia. He went on to perform with John Coltrane, Louis Jordan, and Chet Baker. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that Rice, now 95 years old, will play in Collingswood, New Jersey.
Charlie Rice started out as a tap dancer, performing as a teenager at what used to be the Lincoln Center at Broad and Lombard Streets. When that gig dried up, he moved on to the drums.
And I used to go to a club called the Roseland. It's on Arch Street near 54th, and it's still there. That's where I started out.
Since then, he kept his ears out for gigs.
Down the road!
Louis Jordan asked him to sit in with his Timpani Five band in New York. He toured the southern states with John Coltrane and Red Garland as part of the Eddie Vincent band. Art Blakey told him he was not going to take a USO gig, performing for soldiers in Korea for 4 months, and would he like to do it? In the 1960s, Chet Baker took him on tour through Europe. After that tour, Rice decided he'd had enough of traveling, and he stayed put in Philadelphia.
I just love being around Philadelphia, and you could go to Atlantic City. This was when things were bright and good. It used to be a pleasure to go down Atlantic City on the weekend or go to New York and mess around. 52nd Street was open. You could go in any club to hear Art Tatum, Dizzy Gillespie, anybody, free.
Rice got a steady paycheck and health insurance for pumping gas into school buses for the Camden County Board of Education, a job he held for 40 years.
And it wasn't bad, you know. I really enjoyed it. And plus, I was playing at the same time.
Now that he's 95, Rice has slowed down. He's on a dialysis machine 3 days a week. He will play the Collingswood Community Center as part of a monthly concert by Jazz Bridge. That's a nonprofit that helps musicians with medical and legal costs. He says it will probably be his last show. But, like a good jazz musician, he never says die.
A friend of mine called me and he has asked me to make a job with him. Well, I might do that, you know. I'm just talking off the top of my head now. I'll have to see how I feel.
I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
New Jersey's Clean Energy Program proudly supports WHYY. New Jersey's Clean Energy Program, incentivizing businesses, local governments, schools, and residents to integrate energy-efficient and renewable technologies into their new construction projects, existing building upgrades, and new equipment installation. More information about modernizing in your home and business with support from New Jersey's Clean Energy Program at njcleanenergy.com/WHYY.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The holiday gift that keeps on giving is a fund at the Philadelphia Foundation. You can support the arts, protect natural areas, promote health, provide scholarships, and help the needy, all while receiving tax benefits. The Foundation makes it easy to make a difference now and forever. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.